From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from the DNC in Boston, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency.
There are those who are preparing to divide us, the spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Barack Obama, the U.S. Senate candidate from Illinois, delivers the keynote. If he wins, he would be the third black senator since Reconstruction. We'll hear his full address, as well as speeches from Theresa Hines Kennedy and, yes, Ron Reagan, also a tribute to Fannie Lou Hamer.
More African-American, Asian-American, Native American, and Latinos are here than ever before.
Yes.
Fannie Lou Hamer's single decision to stand up and be counted brought us here.
Ozzie Davis, Ruby Dee, and Maya Angelou remember the great civil rights leader, Fannie Lou Hamer. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, breaking with convention. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 51 people have been killed in a massive suicide car bomb attack in Bakuba earlier today on the first month anniversary of the so-called handover of power. It was the deadliest bomb blast in Iraq since the handover. The bomb exploded outside a police station where Iraqi recruits were lining up to join the police. Dozens were also wounded in the attack. The bombing comes a day after the Democratic Party approved the platform that has been widely criticized by opponents of the Iraq invasion. The platform reads, quote, "People of goodwill disagree about whether America should have gone to war in Iraq." Earlier this month, anti-war delegates from the Denis Kucinich camp unsuccessfully attempted to push the party to call the war a mistake and to call for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Last night, Democratic upcomer Barack Obama and Senator Ted Kennedy criticized Bush for the war in Iraq, but both toned down their criticism compared to earlier speeches. Obama said, quote, "When we send our young men and women into harm's way, we have a solemn obligation not to fudge the numbers or shade the truth about why they're going, to care for their families while they're gone, and to tend to the soldiers upon their return." Last night, John Kerry's wife, Theresa Hines Kerry, became the first spouse of a presidential contender to ever give a primetime convention address. Ron Reagan, the son of Republican icon Ronald Reagan, called for the government to fund stem cell research. While he claimed he was not giving a political address, he ended his speech essentially calling for Kerry's election. To counter Reagan's appearance at the Democratic convention, the Houston Chronicle's reporting that Republican officials are now trying to lure Nancy Reagan to attend the Republican National Convention. Tonight's speakers at the convention include vice presidential candidate John Edwards and three of Kerry's former opponents for the Democratic nomination, Congressmember Denis Kucinich, Senator Bob Graham, and the Reverend Al Sharpton. In news outside the convention halls, the Pentagon's admitted it's playing a far larger role at the Democratic National Convention than it has at any previous political convention. The Pentagon has stationed air, land, and sea forces around Boston. In an interview with the Associated Press, a Pentagon spokesperson refused to state how many troops are in the city, but said the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard all have forces nearby. By federal law, the U.S. military is barred from performing domestic law enforcement duties, but the Pentagon claims an arrangement was made for Boston this week that enables the military to provide support if requested by the U.S. Secret Service. The Air Force's flying combat air patrols around the city, and the Coast Guard is patrolling Boston Harbor. According to AP, the Coast Guard is randomly boarding commercial ships to conduct searches. In election news, the New York Times reporting that almost all the electronic voting records from the first widespread use of touchscreen voting in Miami-Dade County have been lost. The touchscreen voting machines were used for the 2002 gubernatorial race that led to the election of President Bush's brother, Jeb Bush. All the data disappeared after two computer crashes last year, making it impossible for an audit or recount. The loss was discovered by the Miami-Dade Election Reform Coalition, which claims the loss of data highlights the problem with electronic voting. An attorney with the group said, quote, "This shows that unless we do something now, or it may very well be too late, Florida's headed toward being the next Florida," said. The Financial Times is reporting Iraq's unelected Prime Minister Iyad Alawi has established a new media committee to impose strict restrictions on print and broadcast media. Any news organization that heavily criticizes Alawi may soon be banned from Iraq. As an example, an aide to Alawi said any news outlet that broadcasts last week's sermon by the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr will be banned because Sadr mocked Alawi as an American tale. Ibrahim Janabi, a former Iraqi intelligence agency and longtime Alawi ally, has been appointed to the new Higher Media Commission. He's never worked as a journalist. The new media committee will be located at the same building that housed Iraq's old information ministry, which controlled media outlets under Saddam Hussein. The Nobel Peace Prize-winning group Doctors Without Borders has announced it will pull its staff entirely from Afghanistan because of safety concerns. Nearly 2 months ago, five members of its staff were killed. The group also accused the U.S.-led forces in Afghanistan of using humanitarian aid for their military and political motives. Is Democracy Now!, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency, broadcasting from Cambridge Community Television across the river in the unconventional city. I'm Amy Goodman. This is, yes, the program that is broadcasting on over 240 stations around the country, Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV, PBS, and on both satellite TV networks, on Free Speech TV, Dish Network's channel 9415, and on Link TV, DirecTV's channel 375. Yesterday, Democrats backed the official platform that John Kerry will campaign on for the next 3 months. In the years past, the platform's been the subject of intense debate among Democrats. This year's convention has been marked by extreme choreographing. Dissent from any of the dominant positions has not been tolerated inside the Fleet Center. There's no minority or dissenting platform, as there has been in conventions past. The platform accuses President Bush of rushing to war in Iraq without adequate international support, but also pledges to expand the military and special forces. Tonight, John Kerry's running mate, John Edwards, addresses the convention. Last night, one of the most celebrated and legendary figures of the Democratic Party, Senator Ted Kennedy, shared the stage with a young rising star who was just 1 year old when Kennedy was first elected to the Senate. Barack Obama is the Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate from Illinois. Political analysts say his speech last night secured his status as a rising star within the party. Here is Barack Obama's address.
On behalf of the great state of Illinois, crossroads of a nation, land of Lincoln, let me express my deepest gratitude for the privilege of addressing this convention. Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook, a domestic servant to the British. But my grandfather had larger dreams for his son, Through hard work and perseverance, my father got a scholarship to study in a magical place, America, that shone as a beacon of freedom and opportunity to so many who had come before. While studying here, my father met my mother. She was born in a town on the other side of the world, in Kansas. Her father worked on oil rigs and farms through most of the Depression. The day after Pearl Harbor, my grandfather signed up for duty, joined Patton's army, marched across Europe. Back home, my grandmother raised a baby and went to work on a bomber assembly line. After the war, they studied on the GI Bill, bought a house through FHA, and later moved west, all the way to Hawaii, in search of opportunity. And they, too, had big dreams for their daughter. A common dream born of two continents. My parents shared not only an improbable love, they shared an abiding faith in the possibilities of this nation. They would give me an African name, Barak, or Blessed, believing that in a tolerant America, your name is no barrier to success. They imagined me going to the best schools in the land, even though they weren't rich, because in a generous America, you don't have to be rich to achieve your potential. They're both passed away now. And yet I know that on this night, they look down on me with great pride. They stand here, and I stand here today, grateful for the diversity of my heritage, aware that my parents' dreams live on in my two precious daughters. I stand here knowing that my story is part of the larger American story, that I owe a debt to all of those who came before me, and that in no other country on earth is my story even possible. Tonight, we gather to affirm the greatness of our nation. Not because of the height of our skyscrapers, or the power of our military, or the size of our economy. Our pride is based on a very simple premise, summed up in a declaration made over 200 years ago. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is the true genius of America. A faith in simple dreams, an insistence on small miracles, that we can tuck in our children at night and know that they are fed and clothed and safe from harm. That we can say what we think, write what we think without hearing a sudden knock on the door. That we can have an idea and start our own business without paying a bribe. That we can participate in the political process without fear of retribution, and that our votes will be counted, at least most of the time. This year, in this election, we are called to reaffirm our values and our commitments, to hold them against a hard reality, and see how we're measuring up to the legacy of our forebears and the promise of future generations. And fellow Americans, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, I say to you tonight, we have more work to do. More work to do for the workers I met in Galesburg, Illinois, who are losing their union jobs at the Maytag plant that's moving to Mexico, and now are having to compete with their own children for jobs that pay $7 an hour. More to do for the father that I met who was losing his job and choking back the tears, wondering how he would pay $4,500 a month for the drugs his son needs without the health benefits that he counted on. More to do for the young woman in East St. Louis, and thousands more like her, who has the grades, has the drive, has the will, but doesn't have the money to go to college. Now, don't get me wrong. The people I meet in small towns and big cities and diners and office parks, they don't expect government to solve all their problems. They know they have to work hard to get ahead, and they want to. Go into the collar counties around Chicago, and people will tell you they don't want their tax money wasted by a welfare agency or by the Pentagon. Go into any inner city neighborhood, and folks will tell you that government alone can't teach our kids to learn. They know that parents have to teach, that children can't achieve unless we raise their expectations and turn off the television sets and eradicate the slander that says a black youth with a book is acting white. They know those things. People don't expect government to solve all their problems. But they sense deep in their bones that with just a slight change in priorities, we can make sure that every child in America has a decent shot at life and that the doors of opportunity remain open to all. They know we can do better, and they want that choice. In this election, we offer that choice. Our party has chosen a man to lead us who embodies the best this country has to offer, and that man is John Kerry. John Kerry understands the ideals of community, faith, and service because they've defined his life. From his heroic service to Vietnam, to his years as a prosecutor and lieutenant governor, through 2 decades in the United States Senate, he's devoted himself to this country. Again and again, we've seen him make tough choices when easier ones were available. His values and his record affirm what is best in us. John Kerry believes in an America where hard work is rewarded. So instead of offering tax breaks to companies shipping jobs overseas, he offers them to companies creating jobs here at home. John Kerry believes in an America where all Americans can afford the same health coverage our politicians in Washington have for themselves. John Kerry believes in energy independence, so we aren't held hostage to the profits of oil companies or the sabotage of foreign oil fields. John Kerry believes in the constitutional freedoms that have made our country the envy of the world, and he will never sacrifice our basic liberties, nor use faith as a wedge to divide us. And John Kerry believes that in a dangerous world, war must be an option sometimes, but it should never be the first option. You know, a while back, I met a young man named Seamus in a VFW hall in East Moline, Illinois. He was a good-looking kid, 6'2", 6'3", clear-eyed with an easy smile. He told me he joined the Marines and was heading to Iraq the following week. And as I listened to him explain why he'd enlisted, the absolute faith he had in our country and its leaders, his devotion to duty and service, I thought, this young man was all that any of us might ever hope for in a child. But then I asked myself, are we serving Seamus as well as he's serving us? I thought of the 900 men and women, sons and daughters, husbands and wives, friends and neighbors who won't be returning to their own hometowns. I thought of the families I'd met who were struggling to get by without a loved one's full income, or whose loved ones had returned with a limb missing or nerves shattered, but still lacked long-term health benefits because they were reservists. When we send our young men and women into harm's way, we have a solemn obligation not to fudge the numbers or shade the truth about why they are going, to care for their families while they're gone, to tend to the soldiers upon their return, and to never, ever go to war without enough troops to win the war, secure the peace, and earn the respect of the world. Now, let me be clear. We have real enemies in the world. These enemies must be found, they must be pursued, and they must be defeated. John Kerry knows this. And just as Lieutenant Kerry did not hesitate to risk his life to protect the men who served with him in Vietnam, President Kerry will not hesitate one moment to use our military might to keep America safe and secure. John Kerry believes in America. And he knows that it's not enough for just some of us to prosper. For alongside our famous individualism, there's another ingredient in the American saga, a belief that we're all connected as one people. If there is a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for their prescription drugs and having to choose between medicine and the rent, that makes my life poorer even if it's not my grandparent. If there's an Arab American family being rounded up without benefit of an attorney or due process, that threatens my civil liberties. It is that fundamental belief. It is that fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that makes this country work. It's what allows us to pursue our individual dreams and yet still come together as one American family. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us, the spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America. The pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states. Red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats. But I've got news for them, too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states. There are patriots who oppose the war in Iraq, and they're patriots who supported the war in Iraq. We are one people, all of us pledging allegiance to the Stars and Stripes, all of us defending the United States of America.
Barack Obama, the U.S. Senate candidate from Illinois, will come back to his keynote address at the Democratic National Convention at the Fleet Center in Boston in just a minute.
About Peter, talk about Paul. Well, it ain't but the one God that made us all.
In the Water from the album Movement Soul, live recordings of sayings and songs from the Freedom Movement and the Deep South Blues. We'll be going to the tribute to Fannie Lou Hamer in just a little while as we return now to the keynote address of the young Illinois senatorial candidate Barack Obama last night at the Democratic National Convention.
In the end, that's what this election is about. Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope? John Kerry calls on us to hope. John Edwards calls on us to hope. I'm not talking about blind optimism here, the almost willful ignorance that thinks unemployment will go away if we just don't think about it, or healthcare crisis will solve itself if we just ignore it. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something more substantial. It's the hope of slaves sitting around a fire singing freedom songs. The hope of immigrants setting out for distant shores. The hope of a young naval lieutenant bravely patrolling the Mekong Delta. The hope of a mill worker's son who dares to defy the odds. The hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him too. Hope. Hope in the face of difficulty. Hope in the face of uncertainty. The audacity of hope. In the end, that is God's greatest gift to us, the bedrock of this nation. A belief in things not seen. A belief that there are better days ahead. I believe that we can give our middle class relief and provide working families with a road to opportunity. I believe we can provide jobs to the jobless, homes to the homeless, and reclaim young people in cities across America from violence and despair. I believe that we have a righteous wind at our backs, and that as we stand on the crossroads of history, we can make the right choices and meet the challenges that face us. America, tonight, if you feel the same energy that I do, if you feel the same urgency that I do, if you feel the same passion that I do, if you feel the same hopefulness that I do, if we do what we must do, then I have no doubt that all across the country, from Florida to Oregon, from Washington to Maine, the people will rise up in November, and John Kerry will be sworn in as president, and John Edwards will be sworn in as vice president, and this country will reclaim its promise, and out of this long political darkness, a brighter day will come. Thank you very much, everybody. God bless you. Thank you.
Barack Obama, the U.S. senatorial candidate from Illinois, giving the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. This is Democracy Now!'s Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Among the speakers at last night's convention was Ron Reagan, the son of the late president. He spoke about stem cell research, which offers potential help for sufferers of Alzheimer's disease, which afflicted his father for years. John Kerry and his party's platform endorsed stem cell therapy, while President Bush has imposed and defended restrictions on embryonic stem cell research. While Reagan began by saying he'd not come to make a political speech, he ended his address by essentially calling for people to vote for John Kerry in November. The Houston Chronicle's reporting the Bush campaign's now trying to lure Nancy Reagan to the Republican convention next month in New York. The Houston Chronicle says initial inquiries from the Republicans have been rebuffed. Nancy Reagan, like her son Ron, is opposed to President Bush's position on stem cell research. Here is some of what Ron Reagan had to say last night.
In a few months, we will face a choice. Yes, between two candidates and two parties, but more than that. We have a chance to take a giant stride forward for the good of all humanity. We can choose between the future and the past, between reason and ignorance, between true compassion and mere ideology. This is our moment, and we must not falter. Whatever else you do, come November 2nd, I urge you, please, cast a vote for embryonic stem cell research. Thank you for your time.
Ron Reagan, son of the former president, Ronald Reagan, speaking at the Democratic National Convention last night. He was followed by Ilana Wexler, the 12-year-old founder of Kids for Kerry.
This summer, I was supposed to go to my favorite camp, but instead, I decided to go to the John Kerry office every day. Kids can really help. On kidsforkerry.org, we have an interactive presidential quiz. There are 270 questions for the electoral vote. John Kerry will win, plus 25 questions to make up for Florida from the last election. Our next goal is to have a petition for National No Name Calling Day, a day that the candidates don't say anything negative about one another. When our vice president had a disagreement with a Democratic senator, he used a really bad word. If I said that word, I would be put in a timeout. I think he should be put in a timeout.
Ilana Wexler, the 12-year-old founder of Kids for Kerry. The final speaker of the night was John Kerry's wife, Teresa Hines Kerry. She was introduced to the podium by Chris Hines, her son from her first husband, John Hines, the late Republican senator and heir to the Hines ketchup fortune, who was killed in a plane accident in 1991. Teresa married John Kerry in 95. She grabbed headlines at the start of the convention this week after telling a reporter to, quote, shove it when he questioned her about a speech she had given. The reporter was Colin McNichol, an employee at the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review, the conservative daily owned by Richard Mellon Scaife, who is known as the funding father of the right. He helped fund the attacks on President Clinton. The paper has long been a critic of Teresa Hines Kerry, ever since she married the Massachusetts senator and went from being married to a Republican senator to the Democratic senator. She switched her own party affiliation last year. Last year, the newspaper ran an article claiming she was secretly funneling cash from her private foundations to, quote, extreme left-wing activist groups. Well, Teresa Hines Kerry address last night marked the first time a candidate's spouse gave a primetime speech during a convention. This is an excerpt of Teresa Hines Kerry's speech.
This is such a powerful moment for me. Like many other Americans, like many of you, and like even more, your parents and grandparents, I was not born in this country. And as you have seen, I grew up in East Africa, in Mozambique, in a land that was then under a dictatorship. My father, a wonderful, caring man who practiced medicine for 43 years and who taught me how to understand disease and wellness, only got to vote for the first time when he was 73 years old. That's what happens in dictatorships. As a young woman, I attended Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg, South Africa, which was then not segregated. But I witnessed the weight of apartheid everywhere around me. And so with my fellow students, we marched in the streets of Johannesburg against its extension into higher education. This was the late 1950s, at the dawn of the civil rights marches in America. And as history records, our efforts in South Africa failed, and the Higher Education Apartheid Act passed. Apartheid tightened its ugly grip. The Sharpsville riots followed, and Nelson Mandela was arrested and sent to Robben Island. I learned something then, and I believe it still. There is a value in taking a stand, whether or not anybody may be noticing it, and whether or not it is a risky thing to do. And if even in those who are in danger can raise their lonely voices, isn't it more that is required of all of us in this land where liberty had her birth? I have a very personal feeling about how special America is. And I know how precious freedom is. It is a sacred gift sanctified by those who have lived it and those who have died defending it. Right to speak my mind, to have a voice, to be what some have called opinionated. Yeah. is a right I deeply and profoundly cherish. And my only hope is that one day soon, women who have all earned their right to their opinions, instead of being called opinionated, will be called smart and well-informed, just like men.
As Teresa Heinz Kerry spoke last night on the floor of the convention, another woman, Medea Benjamin from Global Exchange and Code Pink, was speaking out. She unfurled a pink-colored banner that read, "End the Occupation of Iraq," that apparently was not one of the DNC-approved messages of the night, because within moments of the banner being unfurled, police were called in to remove Medea Benjamin.
Clear the aisles.
Good morning. Clear
the aisles.
Clear the
aisles.
Go backwards now.
Please clear the aisles.
What's your name?
Medea Benjamin.
Why are you doing that, sir?
End the occupation. Bring the troops home. End the occupation. Bring the troops home. Where's free speech?
Medea Benjamin dragged off the convention floor and thrown out of the Fleet Center. She said that the Democratic National Convention was asked whether they wanted her arrested, and they decided that that would not look good. And you are listening to Democracy Now! At the beginning of the evening, Fannie Lou Hamer was honored. 40 years ago, a group called the Mississippi Freedom Democrats traveled by bus to the 1964 Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City to challenge white domination of the Mississippi Democratic Party. In a historic civil rights showdown, they demanded to be seated at the all-white delegation. The co-founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was Fannie Lou Hamer, the granddaughter of a slave who was raised on a plantation in Mississippi by her sharecropper parents. Hamer became involved in the civil rights movement when she volunteered to attempt to register to vote in 1962. By then, 45 years old and a mother, Hamer lost her job and continually risked her life because of her civil rights activism. In a stirring address, she testified before the Credentials Committee at the 1964 Democratic National Convention.
This America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America. Thank you.
Fannie Lou Hamer, speaking 40 years ago at the 1964 Democratic Convention in Atlantic City. When we come back from our break, we'll hear from Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis, who took the podium last night at the Democratic National Convention, as well as Maya Angelou. This is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Cambridge, the unconventional city just across the river from the Democratic National Convention. Stay with us.
I'm going to let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine. I'm going to let it shine.
Let it shine.
This little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Oh, this little light of mine.
I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine.
Let it shine.
This little light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Oh, everywhere I go, Lord,
I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, everywhere I go, Lord, I'm gonna let it shine.
Let it shine.
Everywhere I go, Lord, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine.
I got the light of freedom.
I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, I've got the light of freedom.
This little light of mine. This is Democracy Now!, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee were on the floor of the Democratic National Convention last night. Fannie Lou Hamer spoke 40 years ago at the 1964 Democratic Convention. And last night, Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis went to the podium with this tribute.
For African Americans,
in the South at mid-century. The injustices had become routine.
If you were thirsty, you had to go to a water fountain for colored people. And you had to hope that that fountain was working and it wasn't broken.
If you needed a ride, you had to move to the back of the bus. And even if you could afford to travel by car, you had to drive miles out of your way to find a hotel that would take you. Long, terrifying miles down dark country roads, patrolled by the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan.
And you had to hope that the single bare light bulb in your motel room hadn't burned out. And if you went to school, you had to get used to learning the same thing every year because your district had only one teacher.
These were some of the experiences of millions of black people, including one woman named Fannie Lou Hamer.
Yes, yes, yes.
Born to a sharecropping family in rural Mississippi, she worked on a farm for the first 44 years of her life, toiling under the injustices of Jim Crow.
But when the civil rights movement came to her town, it stirred in her a desire for something better. And from that point on, something took hold of her.
Her life was anything but ordinary.
She endured harassment and physical threats. Despite all that, she registered to vote. And for that, she lost her job.
Then she helped others register to vote. And for that, she was arrested and nearly beaten to death on the jailhouse cell floor.
But she pressed on. She became one of the founders, one of the leaders of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
Yes. They came to the Democratic Convention in 1964 to protest the disenfranchisement of African Americans and the absence of any blacks in the Mississippi delegation.
And there, before millions watching on television, she spoke of her ordeal. What she did, she gave a voice to all of us who wanted more, who dreamed of the possibility of better days. She reminded us of our basic values and our purpose. And she helped this nation find its way again.
40 years later, we stand before the most diverse convention in the history of the Democratic Party. More African American, Asian Americans, Native Americans, and Latinos are here than ever before.
Yes. Yes.
Fannie Lou Hamer's single decision to stand up and be counted brought us here.
Yes. She guided guided us. She guided us out of the wilderness of death threats and disenfranchisement, of lynching and literacy tests, of segregation and second-class status. One woman from Mississippi did this. One voice lifted so many, all others. So
tonight, we pay tribute to Fannie Lou Hamer.
Yes.
Actors and civil rights activists Zazie Davis and Ruby Dee at the Democratic National Convention last night. Poet Maya Angelou also stepped up to the podium to pay tribute to Fannie Lou Hamer. She was joined on the stage by the original, now elderly members of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. This is Maya Angelou.
Good evening, Americans. Quote, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off the hooks because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America? Thank you. Unquote. Fannie Lou Hamer. It is important that we know that those words came from the mouth of an African-American woman. It is imperative that we know that those words came from the heart of an American. Frederick Douglass, Patrick Henry, all the black men and black women and white women through the years have asked questions of ourselves. Because in the most private part of the heart of every American lives a burning desire to belong to a great country, to represent a noble-minded country, where the mighty do not always crush the weak, and the dream of democracy is not in the sole possession of the strong. It is fitting tonight that delegates, you and I, hear the questions raised by Fannie Lou Hamer 40 years ago. It is fitting that every American everywhere asked herself and himself these questions. What do I think of my country? What is it in my country which elevates my shoulders and stirs my blood when I hear the words, the United States of America? Do I praise my country enough? Do I laud my fellow citizens enough? Then there's what is there in my country which makes me hang my head and avert my eyes when I hear the words, the yet-to-be United States of America? What am I doing about it? Am I like one who sits high and looks low and pretends I see nothing? Or am I relating my disappointment to my leaders and my fellow Americans? As Americans, we should not be afraid to own both the questions and the answers. Down pyramids of years, we have asked these questions of ourselves, and we've had some answers. Patrick Henry said, I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. George Moses Horton, poet, black man, born a slave, said, alas, and was I born to wear this brutish chain? I must slash the handcuffs from my wrists and live a man again. The human heart is so delicate. We are so powerful that we need to ask ourselves, what do we do in a democracy about making a democracy stout and strong and robust? Frederick Douglass said, the thought of being a creature just of the present and the past was troubling. I longed for a future too. The love of democracy motivated Harriet Tubman to seek and find freedom for herself, but not just for herself. She went back innumerable times to the slave South to gain liberty for slaves and also to instill in the minds of Americans that it is possible and plausible to own the dream, which is freedom and liberty and democracy. Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party were standing on the shoulders of history when they sought to unseat evil from its presumed safe perch on the back of all American people. It is fitting that we honor those dreams of the people who thought we can get rid of evil, the evil of ignorance, by seating the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. We are honored that they are with us here tonight because of their gifts to us, their gifts to history, because of their gifts to our future. May I ask you, please let us support and agree and salute the surviving members of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party.
That was poet Maya Angelou on the floor of the Democratic National Convention at the podium honoring Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer, who addressed the Credentials Committee of the Democratic National Convention in 1964. When she gave one of her addresses in 1964, the president at the time, Lyndon Johnson, also gave an address to take the media spotlight away from her and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Interesting, last night, Robert Caro also addressed the Democratic National Convention, the biographer of Lyndon Johnson. Tonight, Jesse Jackson will be at the podium, as well as John Kerry's former rivals, Al Sharpton, Dennis Kucinich, and as well Florida Senator Bob Graham. This is a highly scripted convention. They don't allow dissent in the platform or oftentimes on the floor, with Kucinich delegates telling us that some of their messages were taken from them, their placards and kerchiefs that said, "Peace, Delegate." Underlying the scripts and the choreography, tens of millions of dollars. The Democratic Convention in Boston this week has cost $95 million to produce, making it the most expensive political party convention in history. On top of that, Senator John Kerry has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on television advertising for his presidential bid. Most of this money has come from multinational corporations and deep-pocketed Democrats, 564 of whom each have collected at least $50,000 for the Kerry campaign. Sakura Saunders and Prothap Chatterjee of CorpWatch bring us this report from some of the men and women who helped raise the money.
Joining the delegates and members of Congress at the bars, restaurants, and expensive hotels here in Boston are hundreds of wealthy and well-connected Americans who have been specially invited to the Democratic Convention. Many of those at the Westin Hotel have helped the party take advantage of loopholes to bypass the $2,000 a year cap on individual contributions to federal political candidates, raising hundreds of millions of dollars to pay for party staffing costs and television advertisement.
I'm Helen Reiser. I'm from San Francisco. Well, I raised a certain amount of money for John Kerry's campaign, and I have a very good friend who was able to help me come to this great week, and I have the honored guest credentials, which opens up a lot of wonderful events.
The price tag to become an honored guest is not cheap.
It's certainly $25,000 and up, I would say. That's probably the basic amount.
Well, about 3 years ago, I met John Kerry, and a number of us in Louisiana, Calvin Fayard and myself, started organizing the Kerry for President campaign in Louisiana and in the South. And he and I, in Louisiana, for example, headed up a team of people that have raised in excess of $1.5 million there, which is unprecedented and unheard of in Louisiana. Nobody had ever raised that much money ever.
The most successful of these fundraisers get special titles, such as co-chair in return for raising at least $50,000 and vice chair for raising $100,000. Through this process, which is known as bundling, these individuals are rewarded for the total money that they help raise. Over 35% of Kerry's top funders are heads of industry, while 7.5% of them are lobbyists.
My name is Jeff Friedman. I'm a delegate from the 48th District in California, Orange County. I think next to the religious fanatics that have this administration, corporate America is the worst element that we have to deal with in this country right now.
One of the reasons for the new practice of bundling is because 2 years ago, Senators McCain and Feingold drafted a law that banned companies from giving money directly to the parties, a practice also known as soft money. Parties immediately looked for alternatives, such as a new group of tax-deductible funds called 527s, to help pay for television advertising. Ron Lester is a polling advisor to the Democratic Party.
Well, I think everything has been changed by McCain-Feingold. A lot of the money now has shifted to 527s. The parties don't have the money that they used to. They won't be spending money like they have in the past on field, on get out the vote. So it'll be interesting to see. But I think all in all, McCain and Feingold is a good thing. I think it's leveled the playing field, and I think it's a good thing. I think that there are a lot of people out here who aren't registered, who don't really know the issues, and it's important to have organizations that go out and educate and inform them. So I think 527s are serving a very useful purpose, and I think that they're going to play a very positive role in the election.
Some still believe that without strict restrictions on campaign financing, corporations will always have an undue advantage. Again, Jeff Friedman.
I think it's terribly unfortunate, but I'm not sure what to do about it. I mean, obviously McCain-Feingold did not cure the problem. I actually wish they would have a system where each side was given X amount of money, period, by the government to campaign, and couldn't get any more from anybody. But I don't think the taxpayers would be real thrilled with that. As long as you have, I mean, in these days, with 24/7 cable news and with the Electoral College, meaning that, you know, candidates have to campaign in all these swing states, there's so much money is needed to have a chance to prevail in a campaign, that if the other side's accepting corporate contributions, you have no choice. You got to do it, or else, the other side will just bludgeon you with all the paid advertising that you wouldn't be able to afford.
For Democracy Now!, I'm Sakura Saunders with Prothap Chatterjee in Boston.
Some of the companies providing major funding for the convention include Time Warner, Raytheon, Citibank, Chase Manhattan, and Fleet Boston, now part of Bank America. Special thanks to the Democracy Now! Staff, to Cambridge Community Television, and Free Speech TV. Broadcasting from the unconventional city of Cambridge, I'm Amy Goodman.